Evening. I appreciate the opportunity to participate in the meeting. It was just announced, and on the schedule you see that my subject is entitled Financial Responsibility or Responsibilities to Poor Brethren. And I'd just like to begin with one of the first things that was mentioned in the description of my subject. It went as follows. Many brethren in the United States are rich by today's standards, the worth of several exceeding $1 million in total wealth. We are almost all rich by world standards. That's a reasonable way to begin, and I agree with that statement wholeheartedly. It's none of my business how much money you have, how much money you make. If you make a lot, by our standards, because a lot's always the guy who makes more than you do. But if you make a lot, I have no problem with that. I don't think it's any of my business. I hope that everyone in this room can have as much money as they can handle and still do it the way God pleases God. If you can handle, quote unquote, a lot, fantastic. If you can't, so be it. But it is true that if you're an American, you've got a lot of money in comparison to the rest of the world. The United States has the world's highest gross domestic product. Of any nation in the world, last I checked, we have the highest gross domestic product, reported at about $14 trillion, last I looked. Now, on a per capita basis, we're not the highest in the world. We've got a big population. We run about 10th there. We're surrounded by smaller countries like Luxembourg, Liechtenstein, Qatar, a lot of places you probably can't find on the map. Very small populations. But as far as countries of any size, we have by far the highest per capita GDP. In 2000, in per capita in the United States, you made 360% more than the average citizen of the world did. You had an average income of $34,100. The average world income was $7,410, measured in international dollars. To make that really meaningful, compare it to the poorest of the world. According to the World Bank, 56% of the world's population lives in what they call extreme poverty. 56% of the world's population lives in that condition. They survive on an income of less than $730 per year. That's $2 a day. And 28% of the world's population lives on less than a dollar a day. Well, John, the cost of living is less in those countries. Well, yes, it is. But it's not so much less that they can live on that like you and I do. And I hate to make statements like this a little bit, because they kind of end up kind of sounding elitist or something, but I do think it may be true that to really appreciate how rich you are, you've got to get out of this country to see it firsthand. I think there may be some truth to that. You can read the books and you can watch the videos, but not until you've been in it and you realize that if that plane doesn't work, you're never getting out of it. How much different it really is in the rest of the world. I had the opportunity to be in Egypt in 1995. I'm reading in Cairo. And you might see a building that was once a multi-story high-rise of some sort. And here on the bottom floor, if my memory serves me correctly, all the walls are gone. Many of them are gone. All you've got is the pillars that are upholding the building. And you've got people living in that. Maybe they're putting up blankets or sheets to give them some kind of wall. If they lived in an environment like ours, they'd never make it. You see a guy out here irrigating his fields. And some of it's a show, but I think this fellow may have been irrigating his fields the same way his ancestors may have done 2,000 years ago. They don't begin to understand through experience the advances that have been made. In Ghana, where I had the opportunity to be 10 years ago, I read the book before I went over there, and of course it's jungle over there, much of it, and so it says, take long socks. So I went and bought myself a whole bunch of tube socks. You know, I'm going to have the long ones. I take with me 16 pair of these socks. I'm going to be there 16 days. I don't have any reason to believe necessarily that we'll be able to get any cleaned. We hadn't been there but a few days, and a brother from the church is asking for my clothes so he can wash them. Now, how do I explain to a man who's maybe never in his whole life eaten a meal that was cooked over something other than coals that I brought 16 pair of socks and I got a whole bunch of other stuff at home? So you give him some clothes. The people, many of the people in the world have no idea what it's like to live the way you live every day. Now, that is not inherently bad. I'm not about class envy. I'm not about money envy. The Bible teaches us that people can be rich and righteous. Abraham in Genesis chapter 13, verse 2, was very rich in livestock, silver, and gold. He was a rich, righteous man. Having money is not inherently bad. Job in Job chapter 1, verse 3, was said to be the greatest of all the people of these. He wasn't just rich. He was the richest man in the east. And yet, what did God say of him? He walks before me upright, and he's blameless. David, Josiah, Hezekiah, any man who was a king had a lot of money at his disposal, yet they were righteous. Zacchaeus was righteous. He was a tax collector, but the Bible says, Luke chapter 19, verse 2, he was rich. And yet, what did Jesus say to him? Salvation has come to your house today. You can be rich and righteous. Lydia as well may be an example of this as a seller of purple. But with riches comes responsibility. Speaking of something different, Jesus said in Luke 12:48 that everyone to whom much is given, from him much will be required. And I think that is true with respect to money. The parable of the talents we read all the time, and I think we generally think of it in terms of talent, the same words used. But of course, the parable talents money. And be it your gifts or your resources, God expects you to use them in proportion to what you've been given. The man who was given 5 talents, how many did he earn? 5 more. The man who was given 2, how many did he earn? 2 more. It's not expected that the man with less would earn as much as the man with more. We are all of us in the position of being the one who has more, and we are expected to make something of it. The parable of the wise steward in Luke 16 is very pertinent on this. Remember that steward? He knows he's going to lose his job, so he goes out and he talks to those who owed his master money, and he cuts him a deal, and then when he gets out, he's got jobs waiting for him because of how he handled money. Jesus said in Luke chapter 16, verse 9, after telling this parable, I say to you, he said, make friends for yourselves with unrighteous mammon, or by unrighteous mammon, that when you fail, when you die, they may receive you into everlasting habitations. Well, what's that talking about, John? What, are we supposed to go out and buy our friends? Of course not. Jesus shows us what it means in the parable that follows. We're the rich man and Lazarus. Here's the rich man with all this money. Here's Lazarus with nothing. What's the rich man do? Nothing. And so Lazarus dies, is received into everlasting habitations, but he can't receive the rich man into everlasting habitations because the rich man didn't use his mammon in a way that pleased the Lord. That's the truth of it all. My faith will affect my finances, and my lack of faith will also probably not affect my finances, at least not in a positive way. God has called His people to use money in a way that pleases Him, and that means that you're going to be givers. God's people have always been givers. Even before the law was instituted in Genesis 14, Abraham's got all this that he's won from his battle, and it says he gave a tithe to Melchizedek, even before the law. And once the law was instituted, we see that God really wants people to be givers. How much were the children of Israel supposed to give each year? You see my smile, so you're holding off on it. Most of us would have said 10%, right? We ought to look at the law more carefully. Numbers chapter 18, verse 21 says that they were to give a tithe for the Levites. That's 10%. But then Deuteronomy 14, 22 through 27 says they were to give another 10% that was to be used in the festivals where God put His name in Jerusalem. 20% every year was given to the Lord right out of the gate. And then if you look at Deuteronomy chapter 14, verses 28 and 29, if I'm understanding this correctly, it does look like there was a third tithe. It says that it came at the end of every third year, and it was for the poor, the Levite, the stranger, and the widow. Josephus upholds this. He says there were, in fact, 3 tithes, and Tobit, a Jewish book that's in the Apocrypha, says there was as well. If that's correct, how much, on average, was the Jew tithing each year? 33%, right? 23%, pardon me. 23%. 23%. In addition to the free will offerings, the sacrifices, and whatever else he or she might have given in his personal life. That's 23 off the top, plus everything else that you're supposed to do. This is what the law said, if we've got that correct. In addition to this, Leviticus chapter 19, starting in verse 9, when you went out to reap your land, what were you to do? Do not, you shall not wholly reap the corners of your field, nor shall you gather the gleanings of your harvest. You shall not glean your vineyard, nor shall you gather every grape of your vineyard. You shall leave them for the poor and the stranger. That's, of course, what Ruth was capitalizing on in Ruth chapter 2, verse 3. Not only are you to be given that 23%, not only are you to be offering free will offerings and your sacrifices, but when you do go out to glean all that hard work you did, you leave the corners and you leave some grapes out there so that the poor will have something. Doesn't sound very American, but it's very biblical.
And in the New Testament, nothing changed.
John in Luke chapter 3, verse 11, the Baptist said, "He who has two tunics, let him give to him who has none. And he who has food, let him do likewise." Give 50% of what you've got, if that's what's needed, by he who is around you. Jesus said to the Pharisees, "Give alms of such things as you have." Jesus said to his disciples, "Give to everyone who asks of you." Jesus himself, it appears, gave to the poor. When Judas got up and left at the upper room that night and took off, Jesus said, "What you do, do quickly." When he left, where did the apostles think he had gone? John chapter 13, verse 29 says, some of them thought that perhaps he'd gone to buy things for the feast. Others thought Jesus had told him to go give something to the poor. Of course, Jesus would practice what he preached. Hebrews 13, 16 says, "Do not forget to do good and to share, for with such sacrifices God is well pleased." And if none of that convinces you, I would think Matthew 25 would. Matthew 25, beginning in verse 35, Jesus shows us the measure by which He will judge people on the judgment day. It's not the only thing, but of all the things that the Lord could have chosen to show by as the measure by which He'll judge people, what did the Lord choose? He said in Matthew 25, beginning in verse 35, "I was hungry, and you gave me food. I was thirsty, and you gave me drink. I was a stranger and you took me in. I was naked and you clothed me." Not "I taught mutual edification and you did it." Not "I taught a cappella music and you did it." Not "I taught baptism for the remission of the sins and you did it." Although those things are important and we must heed them. The Lord said, "You were givers. Therefore come into me." Giving is mercy. Micah chapter 6 verse 8. What does the Lord require of you? But to what? Do justly and love mercy. Jesus said in Luke 6, 35, "Love your enemies, do good, and lend, hoping for nothing in return." You know, somebody said that something along the lines, you might as well go ahead and give rather than lend. The return's about the same. And there's a measure of truth to that, I'm sure, if you've got any experience at all. Give, lend, not hoping for anything in return. And you will be great, your reward will be great, and you will be sons of the Most High, for God is kind. He is kind to the unthankful and evil. Therefore, be merciful, just as your Father also is merciful. Mercy is one of the weightier matters of the law, Jesus said, Matthew 23, verse 23. And how do you show mercy? Among other things, by giving. And that giving and that mercy, though expressed to all, and we begin to come now more focused to our subject this evening, is to be especially directed towards faithful brethren. Remember the tithe again. The first tithe went to who? The Levites. The second tithe went to the Jews who went down to the feast. And that third tithe, if I understand that correctly, I've got that right, it went to, yes, the stranger, but also the Levite and the poor. The overwhelming majority of the tithes that they were commanded to give were going to fellow Jews. Therefore, as we have opportunity, Paul said, let us do good to all, especially those who are of the household of faith. And maybe the best case study for what we're going to be talking about the remainder of the evening is what happened in the first century with the churches in Judea. Acts chapter 11, verses 28 and 29, you recall that Agabus and other prophets came up to Antioch. And Luke tells us that Agabus stood up and showed by the Spirit that there was going to be a great famine throughout all the world, which also happened in the days of Claudius Caesar. The disciples then, each according to his ability, determined to send relief to the brethren dwelling in Judea. For some reason, this famine was going to have a great impact on the brethren in Judea, and the church at Antioch decided to send relief. But were they the only ones? No. 1 Corinthians chapter 16, verse 1, we hear it every Sunday morning, some of us. Paul gave orders to the churches of Galatia. Well, what churches were in Galatia? Well, perhaps as many as Antioch, Lystra, Derbe, Iconium, four congregations right there. I gave orders to them. They're going to be helping with this relief that I'm sending down to that we're sending down to Judea. In 2 Corinthians 9, verse 2, the church at Achaia. In 1 Corinthians 16, of course, the church at Corinth. In 2 Corinthians 8, the churches of Macedonia. Thessalonica, Berea, the Philippines. At least nine congregations were contributing to helping the brethren in Judea, and likely they were more. And they all knew each other really well and were on a first-name basis, right? different ethnic backgrounds, cultural backgrounds, linguistic backgrounds. Most of these churches filled with people who would never see the people to whom the money was going, at least not while they were in the flesh. And among these churches, perhaps the ones that stand out the most are the Macedonians. Because the Macedonians were filthy rich like us. Paul said in 2 Corinthians 8, verse 2, their deep poverty, not just poverty, their deep poverty, abounded in the riches of their liberality. I bear witness that according to their ability, yes, and beyond their ability, they were freely willing. Here were churches who acted like the widow who gave her mite. They gave more than they could spare. There was sacrifice. You may have well had people going without an extra meal, or going without a meal, or going without something that they thought maybe it would be easier if their family had, so that the brethren in Judea could be relieved. They went beyond the call of duty. The lesson, giving is good, giving liberally is better, so long as it's done cheerfully. From the amount that some people give to the Lord, someone said or wrote, they must be positive that it's the little things that count. How much giving are you doing in your life? Remember the tithe again. Zacchaeus could stand before the Lord in Luke 19:8 and say, Lord, I give half my goods to the poor. I give half. 50%, Lord, off the top goes to the poor. I don't know your personal situation, but that shames me. I was given three questions to answer tonight, and we're going to be spending the rest of the time on those. And I would like what we've talked about to serve as the foundation. We do have a lot of money in this country. Every one of us has a lot of money, or is capable of having a fair chunk of money. The Lord calls His people to be givers, and not just give, but to give liberally. With that in mind, the first question I was asked is, what is our financial responsibility to brothers in other countries, or here, who have a much lower standard of living? Should we be concerned with their standard of living or just their spiritual well-being? Let me read it again. What is our financial responsibility to brethren in other countries or here who have a much lower standard of living? Should we be concerned with their standard of living or just their spiritual well-being? My study of Scripture leads me to answer that question out of the gate this way. The church's responsibility and its goal of giving is not to raise other people's standard of living, assuming that their standard of living meets their needs. Romans chapter 11, chapter 12, verse 13 says that the saints are to be involved in distributing to the needs of the saints. The needs of the saints. A famine meant potentially a lack of food for the brethren in Judea. A need, a real need, a pressing need was there. You know, we don't try to establish financial parity or financial equality even here in the States. In any given congregation, you've got people who are at a much higher standard of living than others. And if we've got someone with trouble, what's our goal? We don't seek to try to bring them up to the same level everybody else is or that some people are. We seek to meet their needs. And so it ought to be with people overseas. I talked with several via email. I asked for input from 8 of the 9 evangelists among us who have gone to the Philippines. The second question I'm going to be asking is going to be focusing on the Philippines. We've had 9 men go over, but Brother Chick's no longer with us. I asked these 8 men if they would offer their thoughts, and I did give them a heads up that I might be quoting them, although I won't be naming them. And I'd like to read to you what one of them wrote with respect to the needs. He just simply said, there are many honorable Filipino brethren who aren't lying about their medical, food, and shelter needs. And that being the case, we are right in trying to meet those needs. I think there may be some of us here who would love to go over to the Philippines or anywhere else and just bring their standard of living all the way up to ours. It'd make us feel good. We think that what we've got is awfully wonderful and we'd like them to have it. And I can understand that. But do we really want to do that? You know, the standard of living we enjoy in this country does have perks. I mean, I'm able to get clean water whenever I want it. I'm able to get medical attention. I have more than enough to eat. And I'm able to care for others and help them out as well. But my riches come with risks as well, don't they? What did Jesus say? Matthew chapter 19, verse 23, I say to you that it is hard for who? Hard for a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven. Now, the Lord does not say things arbitrarily or accidentally. He has just told us that the condition in which you and I exist right now makes it hard for us to get to the kingdom of heaven. And to some extent, there is advantage and disadvantage. And someone might say, well, John, if you believe that so much, why don't you give it all up? Well, I don't know what the future holds. But there is advantage and disadvantage. Luke chapter 4, verse 18, Jesus said, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me because He has anointed me to preach the gospel to who? The poor." James chapter 2, verse 5, "Listen, my beloved brethren, has God not chosen the poor of this world to be rich in faith?" Jesus told the rich young ruler, "You're guaranteed heaven if you'll do just one thing." Imagine yourself speaking with the Lord face to face. You come to Him and say, "Lord, what must I do to enter the kingdom of heaven?" And He says, "All right, there's one thing. If you'll do this one thing, you're going to heaven for sure." What would you do? I mean, all questions been removed. All you got to do, one thing. The Lord of the universe has just told you, all you got to do is go do it. You're set free. And what did He do? He walked away. That's the power that riches can have over an individual. So, from a spiritual standpoint, I don't know that we would want to do for people what our sentimentality might want us to do. It's also not very practical. I don't mean to make a political statement here, but how many international programs or whatever have really ever succeeded in changing the financial condition or living condition of third world countries? I don't know of any. I can only offer you anecdotal evidence, but I was in Ghana 10 years ago. We were in the little town, little village of Yeji that sat right on side an inland lake. The UN had built them a very nice marketplace to market their fish and maybe anything else they had there. By their standards, very nice, but it sat there empty. A woman, I think she may have been there from Sweden, was helping giving them medical attention. She said to me, "We build outhouses," and I won't tell you what she said next, but they're not using them. Why is that? Because there's so much at work in crossing cultural lines. I had an experience in dealing with a man in the Springfield area when I was living down here. This man came to Christ. He was baptized for the remission of his sins, but he had never had much money. That was the world he had lived in. In the time that I knew him, if he was honest with me, he brought in around $40,000 of workman's comp. He blew every dime of it. Every dime of it. Had nothing to show for it. I brought up to him one time about maybe starting a bank account, and he laughed. And you think, what's going on here? This guy could have totally changed his life. Well, what was going on is he does not have the frame of reference that you and I do. Many of us here in this room were raised with certain beliefs about money, how it should be used, how it should be saved. I saw a skit online, some of you have probably seen it, where this guy's got a new book with a revolutionary idea. The name of the book is something like, "Don't Buy Things You Cannot Afford." Revolutionary idea for many people, for some people. And I don't mean to cast aspersions on people in other cultures, but not all cultures are equal. And not all cultures understand money in the same way that you do. Some of them maybe understand it better than we do. So not everyone understands how to use money in a reasonably wise way. And so pouring money into a situation doesn't necessarily help it at all. Neither does a few classes. We've got a lot of patterning, a lot of background that we can't necessarily undo. One brother wrote this, "We cannot cure the economic problems that exist in other countries, but we can aid brethren with pressing difficulties, including food, clothing, shelter, and needed medical care. If we gave all we have, we would not eliminate poverty among the brethren in the Philippines. But we can help some, and we should." I thought that was interesting, and I would like to close in answering this first question with something else I thought was rather interesting. We all want to know when we give that the money is being used wisely and responsibly. And I don't know if you've had this experience, but it may be that somewhere along the line we may hear things that make us wonder if the money really is being used wisely and responsibly. And another brother who's been over to the Philippines wrote this, and I thought this was interesting. He said, "Sometimes the economic infrastructure of a weak economy might give Americans the idea that a recipient of generosity is wasting money, for example, in buying a cell phone. However, in the Philippines, cell phones cost less than land phones and are more reliable than land phones," which is interesting. I wouldn't have guessed that. So yes, variations in economy need to be considered. So if we ever do hear anything, we need to be We're going to talk about investigation here in a little bit. There's a place for investigation, but we need to keep in mind the differences, and there may be explanations, reasonable explanations, for things that don't sound so good at first. The second question was like as follows. Should we do more investigation of what seems to be a large number of conversions in the Philippines, or trust that all is well and continue to send financial support? I do paraphrase here. Let me read it again. Should we do more investigation of what seems to be a large number of conversions in the Philippines, or trust that all is well and continue to send financial support? Again, I'm speaking to you as one who's not been there, but I do think there are maybe a couple things we can bring to bear on this question. First of all, with respect to the large number of conversions. Large numbers of conversions do not necessarily indicate that something is wrong. We may not be seeing them here. Our culture has lost its religion, and our culture is pretty hard packed in a lot of places. I remember Wade and I doing some door knocking several years ago now, and we came to a particular community, and he made the remark, it's pretty hard packed soil here, something along those lines. It is true that it seems to be harder soil than it maybe was 60, 70, 80, 100 years ago. Nearly 200 years ago now, but in this country, there was a time when huge conversions were not unusual. In 1828, the gospel was so readily accepted by people in Kentucky that Raccoon John Smith, who was preaching the same gospel that is preached here, he immersed over 30 people a week for several consecutive months. I've never seen anything like that in my life, and I don't expect to. Walter Scott, who himself was a gospel preacher, in the years 1828 and 1829, baptized 1,000 people each of those years. Benjamin Franklin, not the founding father, but the gospel preacher, who died in 1878, he is recorded to have converted over 10,000 people. Now, was some of that bogus? Sure, probably some of it was just people getting caught up in the moment and not real. But let's cut the numbers in half. Gargantuan numbers of conversions, far greater than anything I've heard coming out of the Philippines or anywhere else. So I do think that should be part of the package, at least laid in the back of the mind. But at the same time, I will say that I've not kept up with the number of conversions that we're hearing about coming out of the Philippines, but real carefully anyway, but it does seem like when I see them in the gospel message that they're not too big. They are somewhat moderate, it seems like, maybe 3 to 6, something like that. One brother wrote, "Lately I've not heard of tremendous numbers being converted, at least not from anybody that we support already. Only occasional conversions similar to America." Someone else wrote, "From time to time we may hear of several responding to the gospel at once in particular circumstances, as when a congregation of some different background is persuaded in mass to convert. But most of the reports we hear from brethren we know are realistic about an ongoing work and results. Perhaps there are some who stage baptisms to impress Americans in the hope of financial gain. But brethren we have worked with..." Now this comes from the mouth of someone who's been over there. "Brethren we have worked with directly there have no more use for that fraud than we do." Now that's coming from a witness who's worked with the brethren over there. It is true. If you go over to a country like the Philippines, or you go over to a country like Ghana, or maybe other third world countries, you're going to run into people who want to be baptized by you just because you're an American. I had a young man come up to me 10 years ago and say that very thing. "I want to be baptized by an American." There is this strange fascination with Americans in some of these third world countries. My first morning in Ghana, we went to visit a man who's a member of a denomination. They were fixing up their upper room to be the place they met. And he just said outright, with no shame at all, "We want to be like the Europeans and the Americans." I mean, just open with it. "I want to be baptized by an American." That is out there. But we know the men we're sending over there aren't interested in that sort of thing. And their testimony to us is that the men we're supporting, at least, aren't interested in that sort of thing either. I go on their testimony. There is a scandalous side of things, though, and we don't want to be ignorant of that. One brother wrote this, "I am fearful that there are some in the Philippines who think that the best way to get financial assistance from the U.S. is to show the visitors that souls are being converted." That same man wrote how that one occasion there was one place in the Philippines, like something like 10 came up to be baptized. Roger Van Austin started questioning him and found out that 8 of them had already been baptized and had no good reason for being baptized again. So sure, there are very scandalous and deceitful circumstances like that out there. I heard that the question may have been asked, "Would you like to have some baptisms while you're here?" Terrible thing to ask. It is out there. But in spite of those corrupt practices, one brother wrote, "We still have good brethren there who convert the old-fashioned gospel way and are worthy of our encouragement and support." And I like the sound of that. And it is based on testimony, and I do want to deal with this. "By the mouth of two or three witnesses, every word shall be established." 2 Corinthians 13, verse 1. "We have eight evangelists among us right now who are alive and well, who have been to the Philippines, some of them many times. In addition to that," and this was a surprise to me, "we have something like at least 9 or 10 others who are not evangelists who are among us who have been over to the Philippines as well. San Jose has a few members who themselves have gone over." If your congregation or you are concerned about getting some reliable information about what's going over there, there are lots of people, near 20 people right here that you can go and talk to personally. There are at least 3 evangelists who have visited Spain, 2 only have visited Ghana, the more the better. But I'm maybe not as skeptical as I ought to be. Maybe I'm a little gullible. But the Bible tells us to give credence to witnesses. Paul and Barnabas gave witness to their work. Barnabas stood up for Saul, and it was accepted. Paul spoke well of Titus and other brethren. 2 Corinthians 8, verse 23, he says, "If anyone inquires about Titus, he is my partner and fellow worker concerning you. Or if our brethren are inquired about, they are messengers of the churches, the glory of Christ. I vouch for him." Now, yes, Paul was an apostle. But when women who were not apostles came and told the apostles that Jesus Christ had risen from the dead, and the apostles didn't believe it, when Jesus appeared, what did he do? He rebuked them for not hearing the witnesses. I can't say for sure what all those who've been to the Philippines and other countries will say, but if those witnesses give us good reports, I think we've got good reason to take them, for the most part. And that brings us to the second part of answering the question. What I just said does not mean that caution and investigation may not be appropriate at some point. One particular way in which caution may be appropriate is in distribution of funds. When we look at the money that was being given by the New Testament churches and being sent to Judea, who carried it? Never just one person, or at least generally there were multiple people. Paul and Barnabas were carrying it in Acts chapter 11, verse 30, 2 Corinthians 8. There were multiple people carrying that money. One who was chosen by the churches to go with us, Paul said. You've got at least 3, probably more, carrying this money. And Paul gave the reason why, avoiding this, that anyone should blame us in this lavish gift which is administered by us, providing honorable things not only in the sight of the Lord, but in the sight of men. I have no reason to doubt any given brother, but the biblical precedent is to give it into the hands of more than one. So I do think if that's at all possible, we should consider that. And perhaps it's already going on. I don't know that. There may be a place for investigation. Every benevolent act the church does probably should be accompanied by some investigation. If a widow was going to be taken into the number, she had to meet certain qualifications. You might have to look into her life to find out what those, if she meets them. It's not inappropriate at all for us to look into any work that's being supported or any person who's being supported and make sure they are what they say they are. And they are worthy of the money being received. Are they really working? Or are they trying to work? If a man will not work, what? Neither shall he eat. God does not abide lazy men or women, neither should we. That's one thing that ought to be taken into account. I do think, and again I speak as one who's never been over there, but having been to a foreign country and talking with those who've been over there, it does seem to me that we do have one huge obstacle we face in work overseas, and that's the language barrier. I know what it's like to be sitting there with somebody and there's a conversation going on, and maybe it's about the very Bible study you're having, but you don't have any idea what they're talking about. Or maybe you're speaking to a group of people and the translator, he starts translating what you're saying, and suddenly he's going a lot longer than you talked, and he's doing this and the people are laughing. What's he doing? Now maybe he told them that he was adding something to it. I don't know. That's the problem. And I do think there may be a place, and I've brought this up before and I think everyone thinks I'm crazy, but it is possible The military, if I'm not mistaken, teaches people languages very quickly. They immerse them in an environment and they force you to learn it. It is possible to learn a language very quickly. These means may be expensive, but that's one way of going. Probably a cheaper way is to get some interpreters, translators. Now, I'm not casting aspersions on the work that's been done. I'm only throwing out an idea, but I don't see any reason why it wouldn't be appropriate for the church to find a brother or two or three to send over there. More than one would be better, of course, like it's been done. Send them over and send them over with a translator who we have vetted, investigated, so we can be sure this person's reliable. Send them over there. Maybe send them over unannounced. And just let them show up at the congregations. Let them show up at someone's door. And here, have another conduit besides just the people who are there. We may find that nothing's different at all, but I'm pretty sure it may not change the fact we'd support the work, but we'd have a better feel for what's going on. And I apply that to any work, be it Israel, Spain, the Philippines, Ghana, anywhere. There's a reason the Lord gave the gift of tongues to those who preach the gospel. Not only so they could communicate it, but they could know what was going on around them. We'll never know for sure on a lot of things. Maybe you're wondering if you could be sure when I'm going to end here. We never can be sure 100% on hardly anything. As one brother put it, maybe we just have to decide on a percentage. If I can be this percentage sure, then I can feel good about giving this money. Because there is some point, I admit, there is some point where we just have to give. We're responsible for giving and they're responsible for how they use it. But that doesn't mean that investigation is not appropriate. Let's quickly deal with the third question. It is, should the church organize members for working missionary trips to teach and do physical work in other countries? No doubt most of us have heard of other churches doing this. They send a group of people down to Mexico or any given country, and they do a little work for a week or something like that and come back home. Should this be something that the church is doing? If this work is done, I would prefer to see it funded by individuals. As we've seen, the Scripture gives the church the responsibility of meeting needs. I suppose there could be some extreme circumstance in which a need would arise in which the church could fund a trip like this. I don't know what that circumstance would be. One brother did write me and tell me that years ago when he was much younger and was going to college, he had actually gone with a Church of Christ group, not with our fellowship, but he'd gone with the Church of Christ group down to Mexico. And they had done something like this. And his estimation of it then, as it is now, was that really it was kind of a feel-good trip. Not that they didn't have good intentions, not that they weren't trying to help, but in the end, it was more to make them feel like they'd done something, really, than really helping the situation. And if something like this is going to be done, I do think we need to ask ourselves, what will really help? The brothers who've been over there, two of them mentioned to me something like canning. Now, I realize they may not be all on the same page, but this is something interesting, I think. A recurrent problem in the Philippines, we hear about it with some frequency, at least I feel like I do, is a typhoon rolls in and suddenly there's nothing to eat. Or maybe famine rolls in and there's not enough to eat. One brother wrote this: it would be very good if many Philippine families would can fruits and vegetables. However, few do. Canning supplies are available, but not in every store. Few brethren know how to can. There's one of those cultural issues. One other brother wrote, to provide them with canning supplies and teach them how to preserve their produce to get them through the typhoons and droughts would have some value, I think. Finding brethren who would support or be part of the team is a big challenge. Some have offered to help before, but have not been able to follow through. We've not been able to follow through. So I guess my opinion is, if it worked like this were going to be done, if the Philippine brethren or Ghanaian brethren, whoever it was, if they wanted it done, let's first of all make sure they want it done. Let's make sure it seems like it needs to be done or it's really going to help. And then let's maybe have some individuals fund it and go ahead and make that happen. One final thought. Any effort, particularly with money, but any effort does require making sure that we're doing it the best way we can. And one brother related to me how that in time past, some of the brethren here have tried to just send supplies over there. And they tried to ship them over there, you know, and it makes Americans feel good. We've got all these extra things we don't have to use for them. Let's send them to the Filipino brethren. They can make use of them. The problem is, it costs so much to send them over there that they'd have had more at their disposal if we had just sent money. Other brethren tried to send it with them. So we'll just carry it with us when we go. Well, they ended up getting charged extra for their baggage. And again, more money went out. So, it does sound like, based on those with experience, or this one, that money is going to be more useful than us literally trying to ship things, but that goes back to that question. We do want to make sure the money is being dispersed as best we can. We are very rich in this country, and the Lord has given the church the responsibility to help those who are in need. So as we have opportunity, let us do good to all, especially those who are of the household of faith, be it here or abroad.